This is the To The Point podcast. Together with our ERISA attorney, we'll explore key Affordable Care Act and trending compliance topics, all in 15 minutes or less. Now here's our host, Sarah Gillespie.
Thanks for joining this podcast. This is Sarah Gillespie. I'm the Compliance Director at Lipscomb & Pitts. And together with my co-host, Stacey Barrow, we are going to talk today about Section 125 plans. Hey, Stacey.
Hey, Sarah.
So Section 125 plans, this is a topic that comes up often because we have employers who are really interested in the advantages of pre-taxing, both the employer and the employee advantages, but sometimes aren't aware that there are certain documents and requirements in order to do that. Can you share a little bit about that?
Sure. Section 125 refers to Section 125 of the Internal Revenue Code, and that is the section of the code that allows employees to pay pre-tax for their premiums for qualified benefits like medical, dental, and vision. Every employer that allows for pre-tax contributions must have a written Section 125 plan in place. Sometimes these are called premium-only plans if they just serve as a premium reduction vehicle. They can also be called premium conversion plans. And then when you start to add more components, you might refer to it as a cafeteria plan or a flexible benefit plan if there are healthcare FSAs or dependent care FSAs or adoption assistance FSAs. So there's a lot of different ways that they can be structured, but in essence, they are simply mechanisms that allow employees to pay pre-tax for their benefits. The Section 125 plan by itself is not an ERISA plan. It doesn't provide benefits. It's just a vehicle used for funding benefits like medical, dental, and vision on a pre-tax basis. So the Internal Revenue Code requires a written plan document for a Section 125 plan. It doesn't require a summary plan description unless there's a health FSA involved. So many employers will develop these Section 125 plans, put them in a drawer somewhere, and forget about them. And that generally is fine as long as you don't forget about it for so long that you can't find it. The law changes on these plans, but not as frequently as, say, changes occur under ERISA or the Affordable Care Act. So you might go 3 or 4 years without needing an amendment to your Section 125 plan. But you do need to have one in your possession. They are typically part of every payroll audit. And there are also non-discrimination rules that apply when structuring the premiums. In general, you cannot set it up so that your highly compensated employees have a preferential premium contribution structure as compared with the rank and file employees. There are all different kinds of safe harbors from the testing, depending on plan design and employer size. But in general, there is a requirement that the plan be non-discriminatory at all times during the year, and the way that you can test that out is to perform the cafeteria plan testing as of the last day of the plan year.
And how often should that testing be performed?
It depends on the components and really how the plan has fared in prior years. So as an example, say an employer had a plan that was on the cusp of failing, and maybe in a past year it even failed. That employer might want to test maybe 2 or 3 times during the year, maybe at the start of the year, and then again in the middle, and then at the end, so that if they need to make any corrective distributions or any other adjustments, they can do it prior to the end of the year. Another employer who passes the tests with flying colors every year, they may just wait until the end of the year, perform it after the end of the last day of the plan year, which is technically how it should be done under the regulations. And for them, doing it once a year is going to be fine because they're always passing the tests.
but going several years without performing the testing is probably not a good idea.
No, unless there's an exemption or other exception that applies, the best practice is to do the testing. Part of the difficulty or the hesitation, I guess, is that for one, we are still operating under proposed regulations for all of this. The cafeteria plan rules and the non-discrimination rules have been in proposed form since 2007, and they show no sign of being finalized anytime soon. And in fact, the IRS has informally indicated that if they had the ability to kind of recast these rules, they might rewrite them and make them a little friendlier. They are duplicative in parts. They are very difficult to follow, even for practitioners. We're always hopeful that they'll eventually really formalize the rulemaking a little bit and maybe clarify how to perform these tests.
Okay, I think that's helpful information. And if anybody needs resources to perform non-discrimination testing, you can contact me, Sarah Gillespie, at Lipscomb and Pitts, and I would be happy to work with you to make that happen. So another thing that I wanted to just make clear or discuss would be around the conversation of qualifying events. That's another area where we get a lot of questions. The idea that if someone has a premium-only plan in place appropriately and they are pre-taxing, that employees cannot just jump in and out of benefits whenever they want. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, that's one of the primary rules when an employee contributes pre-tax to benefits, is that their election to participate or not to participate is locked in for the plan year unless a permitted change in status event occurs, like having a baby or getting married or losing a job or losing other coverage or becoming entitled to Medicare or Medicaid. These things are generally referred to as life events, and unless you have a qualifying life event, your election either to participate or not participate is fixed for the duration of the plan year.
And one of the reasons, in addition to just the audits and the things that would require you to provide your actual document if someone was to ask that of you. Within the last couple of years, there were a couple more events, qualifying life events, that were added that you could put in your Section 125 plan to allow for mid-year plan changes. And those would be the reduction of hours. So if someone's hours changed and they want to drop their coverage because their hours have dropped, that's now allowed if the employer has chosen to incorporate that in their Section 125 plan, right? And then there's the one where if someone wants to be let out of the plan that is a non-calendar year plan in order to join the exchange or marketplace plan, that the employer would have to have that written in order for the employee to be let out at that open enrollment time, beginning of the year. Am I missing any?
No, that's right. Those two new events were added midway through 2014. They must be adopted into the plan in order to use them. And even when you are allowing people to drop coverage due to a reduction in hours in a stability period or because they're enrolling in marketplace coverage, they have to actually be enrolling in other coverage. They have to at least represent that they are picking up other coverage. You couldn't just let them, say, drop upon a move to part-time when they say that, well, we're just going to go without coverage. So there are some hoops to jump through even for those new rules.
Well, thanks so much for that information on these Section 125 and POP plans. If anyone needs help getting one of those in place or getting one updated, we are happy to help you with that. Please reach out to us at lpinsurance.com for any questions, comments, or other resources, and definitely for other podcasts. Join us next time. Thanks.